Cabinet Committee for February 28th, 2007 will come to order. We have two matters on our schedule today, 2516 and House Bill 2718. I'd like to start with House Bill 2516. Go ahead and give us the summary.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2516 deals with the school equalization formula and what is included in the definition of local revenue that's taken into account in that formula. What the bill does is to exclude the revenue from the sale of foreclosed property due to delinquent taxes from being included in the local revenue in the formula. That by being in the formula, it is essentially those foreclosed property revenue is equalized statewide when it varies by student in the various districts. It would also prohibit the use of the foreclosed property revenue in the calculation of state aid to community colleges. As best as I can tell from data from the Department of Revenue, it would involve about $500,000 biennium. And foreclosed property only applies to real property, not personal property.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, question staff, if I may.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Two questions. Is personal property previously exempt from this calculation, and that's why it's not here? And the second question is, with regard to the potential downturn in the economy at any point, does this figure that's $500,000, or in this case, $435,000, does it go up and down with regard to the economy? Is it does it washboard back and forth?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I only had 2 years of data available to work with, and one was significantly different from the other. So in those 2 years, it was up and down. The first question
was relative to personal property. Why is the request different for personal than real?
Mr. Chair, for personal property, it's a different process. It doesn't go through a foreclosure process. There's a lien, potential seizure and lien against the property, because for personal property, the tax collector can work much sooner after the tax bill is unpaid, within maybe 30 days, where the foreclosure property process is more drawn out.
And is it now exempt from the local revenue calculation then?
No.
Okay, so it's part of local revenue.
Yes.
And would continue to be part of local revenue.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. We'll hear now from Dennis Luke. Mr. Luke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Luke. I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner. Was fortunate enough to chair the House Education Committee for two sessions and the Human Resources Committee for one session. We recently conducted a sale of foreclosed property. We hadn't done one for 10 or 12 years. And after the sale was all done, we got ready to distribute the funds to local taxing districts. We were surprised to learn that the school district had to send the entire amount to the state as part of their revenue sharing. And I'll get into the numbers in a minute. The superintendent of the Bend Lapine School District has also given me permission to say that they support this bill. I've talked with my other school districts over there in community colleges, but I found out on Monday the bill was coming up in the committee, so I didn't have an opportunity to get official support for them. For the record, I'd like to give a little explanation of how foreclosure works in Oregon. First, a taxpayer can fail to pay their taxes for 3 years and just suffer penalties and interest. It's effectively 4 years because the taxes aren't due until after the first year, so they affect it 4 years. Then they have 2 years which they can redeem the property, so that's a total of six. So that's three biennium budgets no taxes effectively have come in. After giving proper notice, the county goes through the foreclosure proceedings, becomes owner of the property, and holds it in trust for the other taxing districts, and then can choose to have a sale. Again, we didn't have one for up to 12 years. The county holds a small amount back according to law to cover overhead, and then the taxes are completely written off as bad debt, not only for the county, but the county writes them off for the other taxing districts. So the taxing districts and the county become the owners of the property, and the taxes are no longer considered any part of that. The property is supposed to be sold at fair market value, and is not to be offered for less than what the taxes are owed on it, but typically is offered at fair market value. An example would be a maximum rate on a piece. The maximum rate on a piece of property is $5 for schools and $10 for local government. If you use that number, and we sold a lot in South County that was appraised at $30,000, the tax on that lot would be $450 a year. Figuring the school district gets a third of that, the school district share would be $150. If you use a maximum of 6 years that property can sit without paying any taxes, that would be a total of $900. If we sold the lot for $60,000, which would not be unreasonable in Deschutes County at this time, the school's share of that money would be $20,000. And that full $20,000 would be sent to the state instead of the $900 that would have been used in taxes. In the strictest sense of the word, this money is from the sale of property and not from property taxes earned. It would be fairly easy for the county to figure out how much property tax should have been received on that property, and the school district could claim that and send it as part of their as part of the funding formula. But it hardly seems fair to take more than you would have got off the property taxes anyway. We requested this bill in the interest of fairness to school districts. Within the last few years, the Bend Lapine District found that it had a piece of property that it owned for several years, and I'm not sure how they got it, but the county had a reversionary clause on it, and they asked us, so they probably got it from the county, and they asked us to remove that, and we did. They sold that property for $12 million. In the strictest sense of the word, if you look at the same theory that's being used here, that money should have been sent to the state to offset their funding. Although I don't believe they got it through foreclosure. We probably got it through BLM or somebody else. But we recently had that recent sale we just had, and there's a chart on the last two pages. The total sales was $851,250. It was actually more than that, but to get the other numbers I needed, we would have had to do an awful lot of research, and it was easier just to take this number. But the total sales was $851,250. The total taxes and penalties owed were $32,000 on those pieces of property. And if you figure the school district had a third of that amount, they would have received about $10,000 in taxes. The share of all the school districts was $283,750, which went to the state as opposed to the $10,000 in taxes. So that's why I'm here. This bill allows the school districts not to use the money for operation, but to put the foreclosed sale funds into a capital reserve account for future building and maintenance. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and hope to get a favorable vote to move the bill to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Luke. Are there questions? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that I might be confused about the intent of the measure. If a school district were selling property and putting it into a capital reserve not to be used for operation funds, I don't understand why that should offset their state school fund allocation that they receive for operating expenses.
Mr. Chair, is it Gelser? Gelser?
Yes,
Gelser. Representative. My point is, I don't have a problem with them sending the property tax money over that would have been generated on this property. The point is that when you sell property, it's for considerably more than what the property taxes are owed. And so that money, if we had never foreclosed on that property, the only taxes that the school districts would have got would have been $10,000. And I don't think this is any different than if they sell a private piece of property. And the reason we asked it to go into a capital improvement fund is to make it clear that it's not part of the school funding formula.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
So this only applies to properties on which the county is foreclosing. It's not if the school district owns a property and sells it that that has to be offset from their state school.
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you.
And it doesn't also doesn't apply. Again, you have 3 years and effectively 4 years. You don't have to pay your property taxes. If you pay the back property taxes, yes, that goes into the funding formula. It's clearly the sale of a piece of property shouldn't be considered, in my opinion, a part of the funding formula.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner and former State Representative Bloom, thank you very much for your testimony today. As a wheeler and dealer and somebody that understands these kinds of things, could you have deeded this particular property so that the one-third interest would have vested in the school immediately before the sale and thus avoided, because any property that the school district sells is local revenue and not subject to the dispersal back to the state. They're selling their own property. Could that have been done to avoid this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no. And the reason I would say no is because the county doesn't own the property. All of the taxing districts own the property. So I don't believe you could do that.
Thank you. I'm just looking for a way around it.
And I was too. I've asked the school district a couple times if they can consider this as strictly a land sale, and they would be afraid in an audit they would be it would not come out well for them.
Other questions for Mr. Luke? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony.
Mr. Chair, if
yes.
I could point out, the numbers we have, the $800,000 is a large number, and the $267,000 is a large number, $264,000. But that is because we didn't do a sale for 10 years. If you divide that number by 10 or 12, it's substantially less in each calendar year. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That gets back, Mr. Chair, to the question that I asked Steve when we began. Number one, here you've got one county with $250,000 of this $485,000. Number two, with the change in the economy, how many more counties are going to have to be foreclosing and then selling these properties? So I think that's material.
Good question. Our next witness is Chuck Bennett. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, we had a chance to take a look at 2516 and compare it to the existing law and the direction that we have been following for a number of years in the equalization of revenue for local school districts. Mr. Chairman, we have really resisted over the years carving out pieces of local revenue and trying to keep them at the local level. Instead, we have followed what has, we think, been a very successful program of local funding. It has worked over the past number of years to result in an equalized distribution of funds. I want to kind of go through Dennis's characterization, I guess, of, or at least argue there may be another way to characterize the way local revenue operates. Nobody is receiving local revenue and then sending it back to the state. There are no checks being written from local government. Instead, local revenue arrives at the local school district, and you receive from the state an equalizing share of state revenue to result at generally an equal amount of money per student across the state. We would the revenue derived from foreclosures, delinquent taxes, etc., all of this rests as a revenue line in local school districts' budgets. It's a very stable source of revenue over time. This bill would create windfalls and losses throughout the state, although I just tell you it'd be fairly small, at least given the amount of money that's involved in foreclosures at this point. I think before you make a change like this in the school funding formula, we would really ask you to take a look at a county-by-county analysis, pull together the data on what this represents, what is the impact here, and perhaps make a determination after that's been completed. Again, the equalization formula has been extremely successful in maintaining a fair and balanced distribution of funds around the state, resulting in reasonably comparable educational opportunities for students. Ideas like this, we believe, would begin to distort that. There certainly are arguments on all kinds of local revenue that could be made that they ought to be kept local for capital or for any number of local activities. We continue to believe this is a state-funded educational system, so we'd ask you to resist this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Are there questions for Mr. Bennett? Thank you very much.
You.
We appreciate your testimony. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 2516?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Lundquist. Oh, Mr. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimony is that once the taxes are severely in arrears, then the county, in effect, goes ahead and cancels the tax, takes possession of the property, and then sells the property. Won't sell the property. Should not sell the property for less than the market value, or should not sell it for less than the amount of taxes owed, and certainly not less than the market value. My question is, what happens in these counties where the counties actually have taken possession of the property and have held that property for many, many years? Does it then lose its character as property of this nature that must be shared back with local taxing districts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't answer that directly, but I think there are some provisions as to alternative uses for that property without going to a sale. But I'd have to do some more research to
Mr. Luke has some information on that question. Why don't you come back and answer the question for Representative Butler?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the property always is the equal owner of all the taxing districts. The county cannot do anything with it without all of their approval. But typically, you sell the property sometime down the road. And then the money is divided according to the percentage of the rate of each taxing district. They split it depending on their rate. So, I mean, we have three school districts in actually four because Crook County schools come into it. But we have four school districts in Deschutes County. Now we have four cities, water districts, road districts. Whatever taxing districts have an interest in that property, it is their property forever until we sell it.
So a follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair, because I am anxious about this. I think there's a lot of property hanging around our counties right now that's been in the name and ownership of the counties for a long, long time. What happens if you've got a piece of property like that, Commissioner Luke, that you have used as a county shopyard, that you received back on taxes back in the 30s during the Dust Bowl days, and you've used it as a shopyard for all of these years for your county trucks, and then you say, wait a minute, that's now downtown Bend, wherever, fill in the blank, and we've decided that we really don't need a downtown shopyard in the middle of a commercial district. Does that then go back? Is it reverted back to the ancient districts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I don't believe, and I know in Deschutes County we don't use property that's been taken in on foreclosure for county purposes, because it typically is not ours. The county does own property that we've got from the BLM. Maybe we purchased it at we haven't in my term in 8 years as a commissioner, but maybe we purchased it during that sale. If you put property up for sale on a foreclosure and you don't get a bid, then you're able to go out and sell it on the open market and take first come, first serve basis. But I don't know of any instance where Deschutes County has used property that took in foreclosure for county purposes.
Representative Butler, we're going to do a little research and see what we can find out about the answer to your question and see if there are counties where that might be different.
I'm anxious about that. Well, it may not have happened in Deschutes County. I think it's happened statewide in other places.
Well, we'll do a little research on that, Steve.
Sure.
Right. Okay. Mr. Lundquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm testifying on behalf of the Crook County Commission, and so I'm wearing that hat today so we keep the record straight.
All right.
It is true that...
Would you state your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry, Lynn Lundquist, Crook County Commissioner. It is true that this particular bill does not probably have a huge impact. It will vary from county to county. It depends what happens. It depends on land values, on a lot of things, how long you hold the property for, you sell it, and that sort of thing. But I am here simply saying that the law is what the law has been as far in generalities, and that is that the taxes that are paid to the local counties, the school get their percentage, and that it's true the check doesn't actually change hands, but nevertheless it's figured in the local support. That's part of the state school funding formula. And just as we had a huge, fight you want to call about that when we had the timber bill of Wyden's a few years ago and what should happen to those funds that go to the state, that when they go to the state or they stay at the local, at that point we determined they went into the state school fund. That was the normal process, that this should happen, and we agreed with that. But this seems to me like it really to be equitable in the process, that the increase in value, the capitalization that's in the sale of the property, should not be going to the state as an offset. That should stay with the county, and I think to stay in a capital account is appropriate. Let's just be consistent. The taxes that are paid off, that should have been paid on that property, that needs to go to the state, and that's what Commissioner Luke was talking about. I think that's consistent with the basic premise of how we fund our schools. Mr. Bennett was talking about we don't want to, you know, alter the funding form and so forth. That's, I guess, a technicality that I believe people can operate within. It's our belief that in this situation, like Commissioner Luke has discussed, that those funds should be appropriated in regard to the taxes going to the state school fund as an offset, the capital going to the local district for a capital account.
Thank you, Mr. Lundquist. Are there questions for him? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Are there others who would like to be heard on House Bill 2516?
I have a question.
The sponsor of the bill. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, good evening. I'd like to thank you for hearing this bill. Thank Commissioner Luke for bringing it forth. As all the committee members know, us in high growth districts, Representative Berger, Representative Green, have a big challenge. And we hope that this bill will...
And, sir, would you identify yourself for the record,
thank
please?
Thank you. I apologize.
Thank you.
Representative Gene Wisnett, District 53, rural Deschutes County. So, we're looking for help, ways to help us construct schools in our area, and I think this is a good idea. It's something we need to look at. We have other bills that we're trying to bring before this body and other bodies to see if we can find ways. As all of you are well aware, we have a system in Oregon that we help each other through the school distribution formula. School districts in Deschutes County subsidize other school districts in the state with operational money because of our high property tax. We have a school district of Sisters whose 70% of their school budget comes from property tax and only 30% from the state of Oregon. Ben Lapine School District receives 50% from the state and 50% from property tax. Redmond School District is about 60-40. All of our school districts have existing school bonds to construct schools. The voters have approved them. But we're still growing so fast, it's unbelievable. So it's a big burden for us to go to the taxpayers and continuously, when you've got two or three bonds, as Ben Lapine currently has, on the books and ask them to pay for more. So we're asking this committee to look at this bill and this idea, and I would certainly appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions? Thank you very much for bringing the bill to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there others who would like to testify on Representative Butler?
Question for staff again, if I may, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Lundquist introduced a new concept that I don't read in this bill.
Yeah.
And that is, and I think I heard him say that, wait a minute, why shouldn't the school, as a definition of local revenue, why shouldn't they be able to report just the property tax share that they would have after that, from that sale, and then local revenue would exclude the excess of the sales price? Now, I think that's what I heard him say, and the bill doesn't say that.
I assume you mean taxes, penalties, and interest.
Taxes, penalties, and interest, which would go then to the go back to the school district. Then the excess would be considered not local revenue. Now, if the bill said that, then what you've got is you've got. I think you can satisfy the concerns that Mr. Bennett brings to us, that, hey, wait a minute, that money should come back into the funding formula. The property tax does come back into the funding formula. Any gain on that property above and beyond that local revenue share would then remain as in the local school district, but not as local revenue. Am I hearing, well, and I don't want to ask you what he said, but does the bill exclude everything from local revenue, is what all of the sales proceeds, and it doesn't differentiate the accrued taxes from the appreciation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I would interpret it to include all revenue. It would also include any revenue that would have been due to taxes going to repay bonds as well as operating taxes. There's no distinction that I see in the language.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I think that there may be an equitable arrangement here with an amendment to this bill which could satisfy both parties, basically cut the baby in half, so that schools could certainly have the taxes that had accrued, including all penalties and interest on that, and that would be considered local revenue, thus shared with the state or shared outside the apportionment formula, the equalization formula. The then appreciation could then be enjoyed locally.
Sounds like you may be proposing an amendment. Mr. Luke?
No, you scared them all off down to center.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, in my testimony, their written testimony and verbal testimony, said the county, it would be very easy for the county to figure out how much property tax should have come in on that piece of property. And this bill was drafted late in the fall, and that's the kind of amendment I would really support, and I think the sponsors, the two legislative sponsors of the bill would also, if you could get that drafted. Thank you.
Are there others who wish to be heard on House Bill 2516? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2516 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2718. And Chris is going to give us the summary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2718 requires local governments to rely on the state definition of taxable income when imposing a tax on or measured by income. So for individuals, that definition of taxable income would be that used for the personal income tax, and for corporations, it would be the definition for the corporate excise and income excise or income taxes. And for purposes of for a tax on corporations, allocation and apportionment done at the local level would be in a manner that is similar to that done at the state level. Also, the bill requires that a license fee imposed by a local government on or measured by income shall be considered to be a tax on or measured by income. And the bill applies to tax periods beginning on or after January 1, 2008. And a couple of examples of local income taxes that exist are the Multnomah County Business Income Tax and the Portland Business License Fee are examples of existing taxes and fees.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Representative Tom Butler from Ontario, Oregon. This bill was at the request of a gentleman who I have never had the pleasure of making his acquaintance, but I understand that he has asked for this piece of legislation in times past, and I believe that he may be a constituent of Representative McPherson, because Representative McPherson, I understand, had similar legislation last session, which was not completed along this line. It's my understanding that the request was that we offer local governments yet another tool to be able to carve out their own destinies with regard to how they get through times that are difficult for them, including times when we may lose public funds, such as Public Law 106-393. The query and the question presented before us in House Bill 2718 is one that basically says, if you are going to have an income tax — it does not impose a local income tax, it does not even encourage a local income tax — but if you are going to have a local income tax, that rather than carving out a new definition of income, whether it be gross income or net income or Schedule C income or corporate income or other kinds of income, that you be able to start that income calculation from an income source that is already identified to the taxing agency and available to the state of Oregon in a tax return. So this bill would basically provide a tool, and Mr. Chair, to be able to collect that. One of the suggested amendments that we have toyed with in this particular bill would be to also offer some direction to the Department of Revenue that they would assist local governments in receiving and dispersing that tax if they wanted to have it as a separate form that was filed really even with the Department of Revenue. That's much beyond the scope of the narrow nature of the bill, but again, this was an idea to be able to help local governments to have a property or have an income tax if they wanted to impose it, but to do so from known numbers. Being able to look at your Form 40, your Oregon tax return, and saying, I am starting with that number. I know there are concerns about adjustments for the PERS, which I understand contractually and probably constitutionally now, we cannot charge over a certain amount of income tax on, including local income tax. If that is a problem for folks in whatever jurisdiction, they would then start with the taxable Oregon income and then subtract the PERS that's on that, so that you would not have a separate tax for the PERS. In other words, you're starting from a known number that is subject to audit by either the federal or the state agencies, taxing agencies at this point.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, Tom, remember last session or the session before? They all run together. I apologize. McPherson had a bill that put together a similar construct that basically anybody that imposed, it was a response, it must have been last session, it was in response to the Multnomah County. And it basically, it seems to me it was a bigger bill. Am I remembering this correctly? And it put a structure around and is this a smaller version of that, in your opinion?
Chair Barnard, Representative Berger, this is a much smaller version of that, but yes, I believe that it was Representative McPherson, and it basically, as I recall, gave more parameters as to what it would be. Here we're just asking that the bill, or that the income tax base not be a start from scratch, that you are able to pick up a tax return, either your federal, which has a Schedule C attached for your business, or a state tax return, which has a taxable number, incidentally, Representative, the taxing agency, the city of, or the county of, or the taxing district of, could choose whichever type of tax return that they wanted to use. If it was a federal income tax return, they could choose federal adjusted gross income. If they wanted to use
Oregon income, they could use Oregon taxable income, and then make adjustments to that. All it did was it said rather than, and you're right, Representative, in the concern that there was over the Multnomah County, rather than start from scratch and have a whole new income tax base mixed up of things from here and there and excluding things that no combination of which could be reconciled easily to the forms that are subject to audit that are already filed, those jurats which are already filed with the necessary disclaimers and modifications to them that are required by law.
Thank you, Representative Butler, for that explanation. We just received a letter from Marcus Holling. Mr. Holling wasn't signed up to testify today, but I wonder if you'd like to be heard. Yes, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I'm Mark Holling with United Finance in Portland, Oregon. We have offices located throughout Oregon, and this bill was particularly of interest to us. I don't know if I should just read what I have in here, if you want me to go through that.
Well, I think people can read your letter just fine, but I think it may be useful for you to hit the high points and the main issues that are of concern to you.
Okay, the main issues that are concerned to me is that as more and more local government agencies pick up a income tax on their constituents, it's just going to get harder and harder for businesses that are doing business in the city, in Multnomah County, and now in Lane County, who has just passed an income tax, to pull all this together and do business with it. Everybody's going to have come up with different ideas on how they should tax it and what the revenue is going to be from it and how they're going to get that revenue. Then it becomes a matter of fairness into how it's being applied. City of Portland, Multnomah County, has been one that has really hit hard on the small business, like myself. We run a successful small business, but with the limitations that they have decided that they need in their own construction of how they tax people, they limit my salary that I can take as a deduction. So, you know, I liken that to like a plumber. You know what plumbers get? Well, you go to the owner of that plumber shop and say you only get a certain amount of salary deduction for you, but all the rest of your plumbers you get the full deduction for, which is more than what the deduction is for the owner on the shop. That's what's hitting the small business owners. It's hitting the proprietors, the partnerships, and the small corporations exceptionally harder than it is hitting the larger corporations that have the ownership spread out over many people. This is just another example. Lane County, with their new tax, could work with the city of Portland and have them administer it for it. But as they're writing the rules for this, would it adopt the same rules that the city of Portland and Multnomah County have? Would they set their own separate rules for it? If they start having separate rules for it, me as a business owner doing business in both jurisdictions, it becomes very difficult then of how do I apportion one to the other? And it would just be so much easier with this House bill to have one methodology for the state, which was then consistent throughout all the local jurisdictions, to apply that methodology on a portion of income to that local jurisdiction and pay the tax on it.
Thank you, Mr. Holland. Questions? Thank you very much for coming today and presenting your testimony. We have three people who are signed up. I think all have our similar positions. I'd ask you to all come up at the same time, if you would. Mr. Bates, Mr. Williams, and Commissioner Green. I'm sorry, Terry Williams. Ms. Williams. And I'll let you sort of decide among yourselves as to who goes first.
Ladies before me.
Oh, yeah.
I'll go ahead and start.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Dan Bates. I'm the Director for Government Relations with the City of Portland, and with me is Terry Williams, who is the Tax and License Manager for our Office of Management and Finance and can answer any technical questions. I did want to raise two issues as we reviewed the bill that may or may not be unintended consequences in terms of the way that we implement the business license fee in Portland. The first is an administrative issue. Right now, we ask individual business entities in Portland to submit one return. Often, at the state level, when they file those returns, a business may pass down profits or salaries to individual shareholders or partners, and then the state takes that return into personal income tax. And so the state isn't as interested in terms of which of those two forms are submitted. The city of Portland, in pursuing that revenue, submits one return. If this were put in place, we would then have to go to each individual partner or shareholder and ask for a form, quite literally bringing in our number of accounts from about 40,000 to 250,000 in terms of going after and seeking the income. It, at some levels, a technical, but with significant overhead costs in terms of managing that account. Probably a larger issue is, as we've looked at the numbers within Portland, we believe that the bill as currently drafted may in fact shift the burden of Portland's tax liability to small businesses in certain types of business entities. Right now we have an ownership deduction that was included in earlier testimony that allows a certain types of entities, sole proprietorships, S-corporations, partnerships, to deduct a certain amount of net income. When you impose the state rules, as we read this to do, it would eliminate that ownership deduction, literally shifting, in our, as we've done the rough calculations, the burden of our fee to, for example, sole proprietorships, up to about 110% more of the tax burden than they pay currently. C-corporations, for example, would see a decrease in about 16% of their share of the burden. And it, again, maybe an unintended consequence as we look at the implementation of the rules as drafted, but it seems to move the preference for the liability towards C-corporations and against other types of entities, often many of which are small businesses. That is the two concerns I wanted to raise today, and if there are any questions, happy to answer those or have Ms. Williams answer the technical questions.
Thank you. I think what we'll do is hear from Commissioner Green, and then we'll take questions of this panel. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you and raise some concerns about this particular bill, House 2718. Lane County.
And I'm sorry, I need to ask you to state your name for the record.
Okay, thank you very much. I should know that. I ask people to do that myself. Bobby Green. I'm the senior member of the Lane County Board of Commissioners, but I'm also the president of the Association of Oregon Counties. So, but I'm not here wearing that hat. I'll be here another day wearing that hat, so you'll see me again.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Lane County has some serious reservations about this particular legislation, mainly because Section 2, Paragraph 1, will require cities and counties to tax income, as you know, in the manner required by state income laws. What this section does, it absolutely removes local control for the counties. And we have spent, we in Lane County have spent a considerable amount of time trying to craft an income tax that meets the needs of our local community. We spent over 2.5 years trying to come up with something that went, in our minds, was fair and equitable. We have crafted the public safety income tax, and we've also enacted it. And as you might imagine, it was after some long, serious debates and community processes that we took that action. Specifically, we created an exemption for low-income taxpayers and low-income businesses. We've also added deductions based upon the filing status. And also, we allow deductions not only for the PERS as required by state law, but we added deductions for other qualified pensions. And as an aside, the PERS issue is the source of quite a bit of angst in the community, because what we continue to be faced with is that, why aren't you taxing PERS? Why are you exempting PERS, I should say, and not other qualified pensions? So listening to our constituents at the local level, we were able to craft something, albeit it's not a total solution to our problem, but it was something that we could get the majority of the commissioners on board with to enact the tax. And that's currently right now, that's what's in place. Of course, it's subject to referendum and what have you. But the main message I want to give you today is that we would like to retain local control so it best fit our community and the constituents that we represent.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To all three of the individuals, perhaps Dan Bates and Commissioner Green could tell us how much. Let me preface my question by saying, Mr. Chair, we heard businesses at the table last week saying there's this wrong with this system and there's that wrong with that system. There's 50 different methods of taxation in the United States of business taxation, and not one of them was the true gospel. I mean, they were all perversions. Okay, that said, as long as we're still looking for the truth, the one single ray of light that may be out there, and you think, Mr. Bates, you have it in Multnomah County, congratulations, and Commissioner, you think that you have it in Lane County by making the adjustments for the PERS and other pensions, great. All I'm looking for now is that I'd like to have you tell me, how much are you spending in auditing numbers that mean next to nothing to the folks over at the Department of Revenue? And how much are you spending of taxpayer monies in administering programs which are so unique that we've got to have, and whatever amount you spend on it, I'm looking now behind you at the businesses, they spend time, 10 times that much giving you the numbers that you've got to come up with. So how much does your administration for Multnomah County cost? How much does your administration in Lane County cost?
Thank you, Representative Butler. That does sound like a question for Ms. Green and Ms. Williams.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Terry Williams with the City of Portland. I'd like to at least first start and say that the beginning line on our form does go to either federal or Oregon taxes, so we are not starting from a unique or odd position. We start there, and then we make some changes to it. Hopefully that are not too difficult to arrive and deal with. As for the administration, I can tell you that the City of Portland charges Multnomah County for the business income tax for the entire administration approximately, and don't hold me to the exact number, $675,000 for this current year to administer their business portion of their income tax. The administration in the current year for their personal income tax was $2.1 million. That includes more than just auditors. You asked specifically with regards to auditors. There are three auditors on the personal income tax, and there are three auditors on the business income tax. Those three auditors do both the Multnomah County business and the City of Portland business license. And of course, our administration is the collection, the filing, all of that. With regards to what the rest of the City of Portland administrative fees for the rest of the half, that also is a couple million dollars for all of the administration, not just auditing. The auditing is actually a very small portion of that. If I can answer momentarily for Lane County, they don't know their administrative costs yet since they just since they just passed it.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, Ms. Williams is correct. We don't have the experience that Portland has, but for full disclosure, we didn't take this lightly. We actually consulted with Multnomah County in terms of trying to craft this, so we were relying on their experience in terms of what administration would be.
And just to follow up, again, are you then starting, Commissioner Green, are you starting from some number that's available on the federal or state tax return that's auditable?
Yes, we are.
Okay. And another question, perhaps with Ms. Williams, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Do you share audit information with the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, we have just recently, based on a bill that was passed one or two sessions ago, it allowed the Department of Revenue to begin information sharing with local counties and cities. The City of Portland and Multnomah County have entered into those information sharing agreements. In speaking with the County Council for Lane County this morning, it is also their intention to do that on their behalf for the Lane County.
I think that was adopted in 2003 when I was on this committee.
Two sessions.
Yes.
Thank you. Did you have other questions?
I just had one other question, and that is, how many total adjustments are there to the Portland income from the time that you're you start with a federal AGI or state taxable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, it would depend upon the entity itself, because with the sole proprietor, where we start with federal income, there's a number of schedules that might have to come together to get there. But generally, there is 2 to 3 adjustments, and then there's an apportionment, and then there's a net operating loss.
Okay, and if I could, and the chair will appreciate this with his law background, how big are the books that are necessary to administer that? Is it one tiny book? How big is the shelf now?
With respect to
administration,
on the business side or on our side?
The
I think he's referring to the rules that you adopted in order to tell you how to administer this.
The law and the rules.
The law and the rules. In your case, it would be the ordinance and the rules.
Chair, Representative Butler, it's approximately 17 pages.
Okay.
Total.
Total, yes.
Oh, it's a little smaller than the U.S. card.
I guess.
Yeah.
What a buy.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions for this panel as well. I think the first one probably is directed at Commissioner Green, but I'm not certain of that. If we found a constitutionally lawful way to do it, would it be of benefit to Lane County to repeal the limitation on income taxes on pension accounts? If you have an opinion about that, maybe you don't.
Well, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, we have made that a priority with our legislative committee in terms of seeking some remedy to that particular legislation around PERS. And we're open to a discussion about how that could happen because I couldn't tell you, I don't have enough time to tell you today how many times that question has come up in the course of a 2.5-year period of our efforts in communicating with the media and the public. And Monday, the other day, I had to answer the same question from the media in terms of why aren't you taxing PERS? And try as we might, we say it outdates us, it predates us, it's something that's in contract, and we're seeking some remedy at the state level. So we would be open to those discussion and see exactly what. But then again, we still have to address the fairness question as well.
So your solution this time was to simply exempt all the pensions, is that right?
Well, to exempt PERS, but also those federally qualified pensions.
Federally qualified pensions.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not the informal ones or
right.
People who put money in their savings account, but federally qualified.
Right.
Thank you. Then the other question I had was, I think, for all of you in general. I'm looking at this bill. I'm listening to what Mr. Holling said earlier, Mr. Holling, about the difficulty of businesses that do business in more than one county or more than one city having to deal with a whole variety of different tax structures and systems. I wonder what your view would be of a bill that was similar to this one, but which allowed you to start from some recognizable starting point, as Representative Butler has talked about, and in fact, that as you've talked about, and allow you to make some readily recognizable adjustments to those numbers in the process of determining the basis for your taxation. Something that roughly approximates what you do now, but which would tend to prevent other taxing organs from starting out from some other basis of their own, which I think is what Mr. Holling's concern is, and perhaps probably other CPA's concerns too. What would your thoughts be about that kind of a modification of this bill?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my sense is since we already begin with a easily recognizable number, we wouldn't have any objection to that. Answering that in the last 20 seconds. So
if we had a rule that said if you can write the regulations in 20 pages or less,
17.
It's okay. 17. Commissioner Green?
Yes, sir.
What are your thoughts on that?
I haven't had time to form an opinion about that one.
Thank you. That's an honest opinion. I appreciate it. Other questions for this panel? Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your attendance. And since I indicated how many people we had signed up, we've had two new people signed up, the City of Eugene and the League of cities. So we'll hear from you gentlemen now, if you would. Yeah, and I see someone else wants to.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Andy Shaw with the League of Oregon Cities. Our concern about this bill, we don't have a position on the bill, but want to just raise some concerns, is strictly in relation to the business license fee portion. Cities take a variety of approaches to raising revenues and have used a variety of approaches to assessing business fees with different policy and different revenue goals. We think this portion of the bill, which is Section 3, would impede some cities' ability to structure business license fees the way that they would like to. Portland gave you one example of how that could affect small businesses adversely in their area. The city of Wilsonville charges a flat fee that's tiered and increases based on income. So this portion of the bill could have an impact on how and who is charged a business fee there. So we would prefer not to see that portion of this bill move forward.
All right. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm a legislative analyst with the City of Eugene. I want to preface my remarks with stating that we have also not had a great deal of time to evaluate the implications of this bill. The city does oppose reduction in local control. However, and that's our major concern, is that this appears to be an approach to kind of take away some of our own ability to set our own fees, and that is something that we typically oppose across the board. I would like to let you folks know that we don't have a general business license program in Eugene. Instead, we focus in on a couple different kinds of businesses. So we have a license fee based on income that applies to telecommunications companies and also to garbage hauling companies. So typically those businesses that either operate in or on the public right-of-way. We also have some other kinds of businesses that will fall into more of a flat sort of fee. Those would be taxi companies. There's some other fees for businesses that you may be familiar with that generate a certain amount of toxic emissions. So that's another part of Eugene's sort of business makeup. But we do have a variety of approaches, but we do... We've kind of been put on alert by the wording in this bill that does appear to limit our ability to self-govern, and thus we're opposed.
Okay. Questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm reading from the bill. It says nothing in this bill basically requires political subdivision to expand the scope of political subdivision's tax or measure their income. Persons not currently subject to the tax. I guess I'm having just a little bit of problem as I hear your testimony, Mr. Kyler, that basically that we're trying to tell you what you can and cannot tax.
Well,
this bill is about income taxes, not about fees.
Sure.
Tell us how we're telling you you must charge a fee in lieu of an income tax or vice versa.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Butler, the way that I read the bill was that in those places where we have a license fee that is based on taxable income, which I'm aware of at least two with telecommunications and the garbage haulers. Garbage haulers, for instance, is... net income less tipping fees, then we apply a percentage to that. That essentially what this is doing is suggesting where we should get that number from. So right now we are going with a pre-tax number. It appears to me in this bill that then we would be looking at a post-tax number, and that's going to change the way that change the amount of money that we're able to collect.
Yes, and if I could simply add to that, Section 2, Subsection 3, I think is the area that you're referring to that does cover that. Representative Butler was referring to Subsection 4. That's a little different subsection. Other questions for this panel? Let me ask one of my own then. Would you have a different feeling about the bill if it were either permissive rather than mandatory, if there were some incentives in the bill for cooperation with the Department of Revenue under some circumstances? I recognize the City of Eugene may not have any reason for such a thing now.
would it make a difference if subsection 3 were crafted more artfully to allow you to deal with these traditional ways of calculating fees sort of based rough and ready on income or not? What are your thoughts about that at this stage?
Well, Chair Barnhart, given that it's kind of a hypothetical question, I guess I'll give you the hypothetical answer, which is that we'd run it up the flagpole and see what people came back with. I certainly do, in hearing the discussion that I heard so far, I mean, I think I kind of recognize the issue here that businesses don't necessarily want to have to deal with different kinds of systems all over the state.
Right.
But I can tell you that people in Eugene certainly take the idea of self-rule very, very seriously.
And, of course, you don't have a general income tax. That the arguments that Mr. Holling was applying to would apply for. You're dealing with a very few larger businesses that are quite capable of dealing with your separate requirements without any problem. Right.
The other thing I guess I'd mentioned, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee, is that I did look at the Eugene Charter before I came over here, and there's nothing in there, for instance, that states that an income tax or the imposition or raising of an income tax would require an election. So that could be done by ordinance. I think there was some concern, at least as I understood the way it works in Portland, is that something that might be considered an income tax and then changes to that would require an election. And I don't believe that's the case in Eugene, at least not in our charter. We could probably do that by ordinance.
Thank you. My understanding is that the general rule for jurisdictions with general taxing authority is exactly what you have described, unless their own charters limit it in some way.
Right.
Thank you. Yeah. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much, gentlemen. And now we'll hear from Mr. Butler, who I understand is the instigator of the bill. And I'm sorry, sir, I had you confused with Representative Butler. That's the reason I didn't call on you earlier.
Thank you for the compliment. I'm Robert Butler, 824 Southwest, 18th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. And this is our fourth time this legislation has been brought forward to Salem. Four sessions ago. So let's cover some points before I get into my talk, if I may, Chair Bernhardt. This legislation is trying to help local governments appreciate that we have to be a little bit of a team player to do business in this competitive world. Now, it's nice to go your own way and do your own thing, but it's also nice that we work well, cohesively, competitively in commerce and business. That's why we have guidelines to streamline our commerce in the state of Oregon. So that's why we are here, all of us, from time to time, is for the good of the state, is to help us work together, team play. Now this bill says if you so choose to use the Oregon in Oregon to use a business income tax by traditional accounting methods, presumably, but if you're going to use a business income tax, if, then let's be a team play. Let's be a team player, and let's all agree on what an income tax is. Income tax is this. It's whatever the state of Oregon says it is. Right now, we know what the state of Oregon says what income tax is. We all understand that. We all feel it. Every Oregonian who does business in Oregon knows what it is and has to. Doesn't have a choice. Okay. So that is the baseline. Everything is to be parallel with that if you so choose to use business income tax. Doesn't go any further than that. You can local government can charge as much as they want. They can run their businesses right out of town. There's nothing in this bill to prevent them from any kind of an onerous tax whatsoever. Take whatever you want. There's no limitation whatsoever. If someone addresses you and says, this is a bad bill because I'll lose money, not you. All you have to do is adjust your rates. This is revenue neutral. So we're not holding back how much tax you can collect or how you collect it or what you say. Only if we play as a team once. If you use the state of Oregon income tax as your model, as a measurement, we're all talking the same language. The same language. We're on the same page. Just look in the code. And that's what you have. Okay. I hope I've answered some preliminary questions. You probably noticed you have some handouts. Chair, if I may address the handout I gave you.
Well, we appreciate it. And again, as I indicated with earlier testifiers, if you can hit the high points, we have your material and we can read it. We appreciate it very much.
High point on the history is that in 1975, Neil Goldschmidt was mayor and was persuaded to believe in the idea that small employers were cheating on their taxes. And what they would do is they might have like a 10,000...
Could I interrupt just one moment?
Of course, sir.
And ask you to move the microphone just a little further away from yourself. We find it distorts a little less if you do that.
And thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the help. As you can tell, I need it. So the mayor decided then that, well, yes, indeed, they probably are cheating. What they do is, let's say they have a $10,000 net profit, and they paid themselves $30,000 of income, and they got $10,000 net profit. What they'll do is say, oh, I'll give myself a bonus. I'll give myself a $7,000 bonus. At the end of the year, December 31st, get my bonus. That's called bonusing out. And suddenly I only have a $3,000 profit instead of $10,000. Okay. So the mayor is very concerned about that. We're going to stop that. But what he said, if you make over $50,000 a year, in effect, tax fraud, change all your income tax calculations such that you don't get your deductions for owner's compensation under blah, 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 blah rules. Got to be very complicated. Anyway, that's a brief history, 1975. 1995, the mayor got together and said, well, that was $50,000 in 1975. There's been a lot of inflation since 1975. By the way, $50,000, a lot of money in 1975. You were making tons of money in 1975. It was $50,000. But 20 years later, the mayor said, maybe the 20 years have gone by. So get a task force from the city of Portland, and they worked out a new plan, better plan, 1995. One thing they said in 1995, well, if we keep this old idea about presumed business tax fraud, that small people do it and you have to presume they're fraudulent, if we keep that, we would at least have to raise the $50,000 to $125,000. That was 1995, 15 years ago. So they said that. Okay, so we're just about done with history. The history of this, hardworking people worked for a year on this. This was a head fake. Never got off David Nelson's desk. Never went to city council. It was a head fake. Now, most of the objections that you hear from the city of Portland are objecting to the recommendations of this report, oddly enough. Okay. That's the end of the history. You have a letter before you, and I'd ask you to turn to the first page, if you might, and kind of explain how this quirksome method of arriving at net income, how it works. In Portland and in Multnomah County, the first thing you do is you look at everybody's income. Everybody's income that you paid a check to, that was payroll. And then you ask yourself, does that person own over 5% of the company? So you go bingo, bingo, bingo. Go through all of those employees, check the ones that have more than 5% of the stock, and those are the cheaters, by the way, because if you own 5% or more and make over $50,000, so you got to find those cheaters. Now that number is 63,000 instead of 50, by the way. The average in the United States is about 125,000. So most of us are cheaters. Probably three-fourths of us small business owners are cheaters. So you go through all that, and then they say, okay, well, you only get 63,000, you made 100. So the difference of $37,000, what we're doing is we're going to reinvent the net income statement, and we're going to add it to the bottom as profit. I call it phantom profit. Phantom profit, because it's not profit, but you have to add the $37,000 to the bottom. So we took a typical case, which is in the case of the sheet in front of you, and what is the consequence? And for a large employer or a small employer, the consequence is that the small employer, by next year's rates, next year's, not now, 63 now, it goes to 80, by next year, they're going to make it a little bit better. It's only four times as much as the large employer. The small employer is only gouged four times as much. This year it's five times as much. So now you're maybe not too interested in how well the city of Portland treats its small business. but we should be, to a certain extent. We should be because Portland is an important part of our state. This state of Oregon gives heavily, mightily, to the city of Portland. Port of Portland, airport, much of our revenues are going to the port, to Portland. So it's important that they do a good job or whatever they're doing. Well, what they're doing right now is disgracing every small employer that's successful in the city limits. So that's an example of how you let local control get carried away too far. We're doing bizarre things like this. Okay, well, I testified in 2001 on this bill before this committee. The city of Portland had a whole bunch of excuses why they couldn't do it. And I left those excuses. I'll just hit high points. I left those excuses with you. That's the next page. Terry Williams' testimony in March 2001. Basically, it said the high point was that if this passed, the city of Portland would lose $10 million. What an unfortunate comment to make about the truth. They also made some complaints about the fact that they wanted to use income and not use the four standard base of income determination that the state of Oregon uses, rather than single test, four test. The committee came up with the four test as something to very much investigate. So much for this. The city of Portland was very disappointing in their testimony last time, and of course I didn't have an opportunity to just refute it, so I refute it today, heavily refute it. And the next page happens to be from this report, and it just says $125,000 for today is ridiculous. It's 1995 1991 is when it should be $125,000 allowable. The current code in Portland, which is the next page, page after the next page, in 2011, it gets up to $125,000 maybe. Okay. Well, what's big business think about this? This is the letter from the Oregonian. Editorial. You know, the interesting thing about the Oregonian is finally they said something. The mayor and council are poised to scale back the city's onerous business license fees. That's the most important word in the letter. Onerous. Yes, indeed, it's been onerous. It's terrible, particularly what happens to small employers. Do you imagine what would happen if we took away this deduction back to small employers and just raise the tax rate, you know, maybe 10%. Just raise it 10%, then give all the small employers all of their deductions like everybody else gets. Do you know what would happen? Oregonian would go right through the ceiling. They'd probably lose $1 million. They don't want that. They don't want fairness. Oh, no. So they're very much opposed to fairness, and it's in the Oregonian. They support the continuation of this unfairness. Okay, so on the next page, yes, the city of Portland passed another ordinance. It says by 2011, well, this cap will be up to $125,000, and they'll invent something about man count and so on and so forth that make it progressive. So that's that page, and the last page might be the last page. Here's a letter from 1995 to Veracats saying how absurd this process was in 1995. The effect it has on small business is insulting. 1995. We're still there. And then here is the letter, the last page, you might have the last page. It's from a venture capital firm. A man suggests to this very prestigious panel, committee, that venture capital is probably the engine of our future in the state of Oregon in this world economy. Okay, they provide a very worthwhile service to us and our future. I may offer that, please. Well, they found out that if they get some investors together to invest in bioscience technology, it may result in thousands of jobs. They get those investors together, maybe from San Francisco, maybe from New York, and whatever, and they throw in and invest with this venture capitalist in downtown Portland in the Spalding building on Stark Street. And those venture investors, they make money as a result of this? City income tax. They get a city income tax for that investment. And Multnomah County. They moved to Hillsboro. They're gone. Yeah. Yeah. No. Driving. Drove around town. They can't attract businesses for that reason. You've been excellent listeners, and I very much appreciate that. This is a problem that is so overdue. It really needs help. It's good for the state of Oregon. It's good for our commerce. It's good for us to work more efficiently together. And I urge that we roll up our sleeves and, after four legislatures, get this thing solved in a revenue-neutral manner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Are there questions for Mr. Butler? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony very much. Are there others who want to be heard on House Bill 2718? I see none. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2718. And colleagues, having exhausted our agenda yet again, we are adjourned. Before we adjourn, and before I hit the gavel, I should tell you that we are meeting tomorrow morning at 8:45 with the Senate Revenue Committee to hear the revenue estimate. Our administrator has taken pity on the committee, and there will be no afternoon meeting tomorrow. So enjoy your free time. We'll get some work done in the office, and we'll see you tomorrow morning and then Friday afternoon. Thank you. We are adjourned.
Tomorrow morning at 8:45.